welfare of the children of KJL and MAM parents.
Good morning and welcome this morning. I want to say a few things before we begin. The first is that you have a choice between the podium to stand at, and the one in the middle does adjust for height. So if you want to take a moment to do that, please go ahead. In addition, I'm sure you're aware of our special rules that allow for a 15-minute principal argument followed by a 5-minute rebuttal for appellant. And the last thing I'll say is that before you begin, if you could please pronounce your name for us and that of your client, as well as tell us how you'd like us to refer to you and your client during the argument this morning. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Ellen Morrissey, and I'm a certified student attorney practicing under the supervision of attorney Matt Ralston, who is present today. We represent appellant mother Kayla LaPointe, who is also here in the courtroom with us. This court should reverse the district court's decision to terminate Ms. LaPointe's parental rights because Ms. LaPointe is a loving mother who has demonstrated her devotion and her commitment to her children. And ultimately, she is being punished because she did not know that the father had been abusing their children. This court should reverse for three reasons. First, the evidence submitted by respondent is insufficient to support the court's termination of Ms. LaPointe's parental rights. Second, the district court erred both when it improperly shifted the burden of proof to Ms. LaPointe and when it violated Ms. LaPointe's substantive and due process rights. And third, terminating Ms. LaPointe's parental rights is not in the best interest of the children. In termination of parental rights cases, the reviewing court determines whether the district court's findings address the statutory criteria, are supported by substantial evidence, and are not clearly erroneous. This court reviews the record to determine whether the evidence is clear and convincing. Respondent's going to argue that the district court made several credibility determinations in its order, and we're asking you to review and reverse those. That's not what we're asking. Although we don't agree with the district court's credibility determinations, we are not asking you to review or reverse them. A careful review of the record will show that the district court's findings are not supported by substantial evidence, because the evidence submitted by respondent is insufficient to support the court's termination of Ms. LaPointe's parental rights. Minnesota Statute 260C.317 says the district court may terminate parental rights if clear and convincing evidence established that at least one statutory basis for termination exists and termination is in the child's best interest. In our case, the court's analysis of each of the four statutory factors was a variation of the same theme, that the children were injured again after the first child protection case closed, and thus each statutory basis was met. The district court's finding that appellant failed to comply with parental duties is clearly erroneous. In this case, the court found that Ms. LaPointe failed to comply with her parental duties because she either knew or should have known that father was the abuser.
If you could focus in on the egregious harm, and you're not contesting that there was egregious harm to the one or more of the children, correct?
Correct. We are not contesting that there was egregious harm.
All right. So help me, and you anticipated this already, but help me tease apart the findings of fact where the district court disbelieved your client's representations that she had broken off the relationship with dad. Dad was not going to be allowed around the children anymore. So she didn't find that credible. So how do I tease that apart from the court's legal conclusion that therefore the egregious harm standard has been met?
So I can understand why that would be confusing. The fact is, our view of the case is that there was not substantial evidence that there was a continuing relationship with the father. And the court did shift the burden in that case as well by saying, prove to us that there is no relationship with the father. And in fact, it wasn't Ms. LaPointe's burden to prove anything. And the district court then had to rely on Ms. LaPointe to prove that, when in fact that wasn't her burden to prove.
Well, let's stay on the burden question, but I do want to come back to the chief judge's question. But on the burden question, if the district court says in the passive voice, there was clear and convincing evidence that fill in the blank about a fact, isn't that implicitly saying that whoever had the burden to show clear and convincing has shown it, right? It's not that the district court did not say in the negative, there is no clear and convincing evidence to show. It's stated in the positive and in the passive, which to me implicitly, it doesn't really matter at that point then who has the burden, because whoever had the burden has met it by clear and convincing evidence, right? And so it's stated in the affirmative, it's stated in the passive. Isn't that enough for us to conclude that the district court applied the proper burden?
No, Your Honor, and it actually is stated as respondent mother has not demonstrated by clear and convincing evidence that she could care for and protect her children. And it is stated that way in the order. And that is just one sentence, but when an order does have rampant errors, that those errors become very harmful, and that is a very harmful error to put the burden on us.
What are the other rampant errors in the order?
So other rampant errors would be...
aside from your contesting the conclusions, I get that.
The reasonable efforts finding. The district court found...
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but reasonable efforts aren't relevant if there's egregious harm, are they?
They are not, but it's just another clear error the district court made in its order. And although reasonable efforts weren't required in this case, the district court still found them, and the district court still found that reasonable efforts failed to reunify the family. That was never the point of the reasonable efforts offered in this case. So there's another clear error to find that when reasonable efforts weren't given in this case because they were not real or genuine, and then that they failed to reunify when that was never the intention of the reasonable efforts.
And I didn't mean to take us on a bit of a tangent. I'll let the chief judge jump in if she wants you to go back to the question, disentangling that fact issue from the legal issue. Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm good.
Okay.
So heading back to my, that the district court's finding that appellant failed to comply with parental duties, that finding was also clearly erroneous. To come to that conclusion, the court speculated about the size of the apartment, the fact that Ms. LaPointe met father in middle school, and the fact that father had been emotionally abusive to Ms. LaPointe in the past. And the court simply ignored Ms. LaPointe's testimony that she has never seen father be violent with the children, either physically or verbally. And in this case, the department simply did not present clear and convincing evidence to support that finding that Ms. LaPointe failed to comply with parental duties. The district court also erroneously found that Ms. LaPointe was palpably unfit to parent. To find a parent palpably unfit, the court must find a consistent pattern of specific conduct or of specific conditions directly relating to the parent and child relationship, which has been determined by the court to be of a duration or nature that renders the parent unable to care for the ongoing physical, mental, and emotional needs of the children. And in the Minnesota Supreme Court case in Rewelfare of Solomon, the court said that if the parent remains permanently unable to care for the child, then the rights should be terminated. But if the evidence indicates that within a foreseeable time the parent will be able to care for the child, then the court should continue with the supervised plan to give custody to the parent when appropriate. Despite the fact that the department offered Ms. LaPointe voluntary case plans with no intention to reunify, Ms. LaPointe worked and completed both of those case plans. She also moved away from the father of her children. She was and is determined to prove that she is able to care for the ongoing needs of her children. Instead of focusing on the evidence of Ms. LaPointe's ability to care for the children for the foreseeable future, the court in our case only focused on past history and the fact that mother did not protect the children against an unknown abuser.
How do you respond to the court's findings that your client minimized the harm to the kids, the fact that the older child kept saying, "Dad did this"? She put particular emphasis on, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but Ms. Galupa's testimony, who initially supported, reunification, But how, I mean, how do you respond to that? That's evidence, right? That there's the judge is persuaded that there's an ongoing concern about the safety of these kids.
No, Your Honor, that isn't enough evidence. And I believe your initial question was about minimizing the injuries. Ms. LaPointe actually brought her children to the doctor, obtained second opinions, got genetic screening. She was not minimizing the injuries that she saw. She was reasonably responding to them and acting protectively with her children. Another example of her acting protectively was with her grandmother. When she noticed grandmother was abusing drugs again, was using again, she cut off all contact with that grandmother. That was someone who had been taking care of the kids around the time of the abuse. So she has been very protective, and the department simply didn't present enough evidence that she hasn't been. The court also erred in finding that termination was warranted under the egregious harm statutory provision, and this might get back to your question, Your Honor. A child has experienced egregious harm in the parent's care, which is of a nature, duration, or chronicity that indicates a lack of regard for the child's well-being, such that a reasonable person would believe it contrary to the best interests of the child or of any child to be in the parent's care.
Counsel, if that's the case, and the court found that their children suffered horrific injuries and found that your client had sufficient reason to know that the father was abusing those children and failed to protect those children, why isn't that egregious harm?
So, Your Honor, we're not contesting that it was egregious. We're saying these injuries were egregious. There were multiple fractures, and there was significant ear bruising.
And they were external, so they were visible to people observing the children.
So the ear bruising was visible. The fractures were not visible.
Understand.
And she brought in her children to the doctor, when she noticed the ear bruising, obtained second opinions, got genetic screening. Our argument with this egregious harm is that the department presented insufficient evidence that the harm was of a nature, duration, or chronicity such that Ms. LaPointe would have reason to know it was occurring. And that's due to the invisibility of the fractures. The testimony is clear that major injuries happened when Ms. LaPointe was not present. And the nature of the fractures was such that they were not visible. And the doctor in this case that they brought them to also stated that a reasonable parent wouldn't have known that ear bruising was a sign of abuse. As soon as Ms. LaPointe saw that ear bruising, she brought her child to the doctor. And the department presented zero evidence that Ms. LaPointe ever demonstrated a lack of regard for her children's well-being. In its order, the court repeatedly assumed that Ms. LaPointe knew father was dangerous, saying Ms. LaPointe had good reason to know that father injured the children in the 2020 case. This statement is also clearly erroneous, given the fact that the department's social worker testified that the department, the guardian ad litem, the professionals with years of experience, training, and the benefit of an outside perspective, did not know.
Aren't there 24/7, though? I mean, I move along with your argument. I'm just not persuaded by that.
Okay. This brings me to my second point, that the district erred both when it improperly shifted the burden of proof to Ms. LaPointe and when it violated Ms. LaPointe's procedural and substantive due process rights. In termination of parental rights cases, the county bears the burden of proving the grounds by clear and convincing evidence. And in this case, the court didn't hold respondent to that burden.
Well, let me come back to that. And I didn't want to follow up because we were in the middle of a tangent, but you are correct that there is that statement that the district court makes. I think it's on page 18, paragraph 22.69. But each of the conclusion of law paragraphs, they each say it in the affirmative and in the passive. There was clear and convincing evidence that. So, again, I'll ask that same question. In light of the conclusion of law paragraphs, is it clear that the district court shifted the burden?
It is clear, Your Honor, simply because the department presented insufficient evidence.
Well, that's a different argument. Whether they presented sufficient evidence is separate from did the district court apply the correct standard of proof and burden of proof. I should say the standard of proof is not it's who has the burden to meet that standard of proof. And it seems from the conclusions of law that the district court applied the burden properly. Although there is that statement, as you point out, in that one paragraph during the findings of fact And again, the context of that, too, if I'm not mistaken, is discussing an opinion from the guardian ad litem, and the district court is explaining, commenting on the credibility it is giving to that opinion, and then justifies that by saying because respondent has not demonstrated. So, again, putting that one statement in its proper context, is it clear that the district court shifted the burden?
It is still clear to us, Your Honor, because that's the only explanation for terminating Ms. LaPointe's parental rights, is if the district court shifted the burden, because there wasn't sufficient evidence given by the department in this case. And the court terminated Ms. LaPointe's parental rights in the end because she couldn't present enough evidence to convince the court she did not know father was a danger to the children. I see my time is almost up. Can I briefly conclude?
Go ahead.
Termination of Ms. LaPointe's parental rights is not in the best interests of the children. Everyone who testified agreed that there is a strong, continuing bond between Ms. LaPointe and the children. Additionally, the guardian ad litem, who is in charge of advocating for the child's best interests, stated that in our case, it was in the children's best interests for Ms. LaPointe's parental rights not to be terminated. As of the date of this trial, Ms. LaPointe has moved out of the shared apartment, has stable housing for the children, has successfully completed all aspects of both case plans, and was continually engaged with the department, her children, and the professionals. Based upon the foregoing reasons, Ms. LaPointe respectfully requests this court reverse the district court's findings and order and return her children to their mother. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor and Counsel, and may it please the court. Excuse me. My name is Britta Rapp from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case, who is Hennepin County Child Protection, which I will be referring to, as Your Honors can, as well as the department. The crux of appellant's challenge in this case is that there was insufficient evidence that the mother either knew or should have known that her children were being physically abused. However, as argued in my brief and noted repeatedly in the district court's order, there was substantial evidence in the record to support this finding that was made throughout the district court's order. In her brief, appellant largely takes issue with how the district court weighed the evidence in the case and with credibility findings. Despite what was just mentioned in oral arguments, they are challenging the district court's credibility findings, which are supposed to be afforded significant deference.
So, if I could interrupt, what's troubling me, and this is it's a sad case. I mean, it's a really sad case, as these tend to be. But what's troubling me is an awful lot in this case rests on the district court's finding. The mother is not going to keep dad away from the kids, and not much else, because it appears that it's dad that's the problem here, and that he was the abuser. I mean, he pled guilty, he whatever. So was that established? I mean, assuming that's a fact-finding as opposed to some kind of other conclusion, is that supported by clear and convincing evidence? I mean, that seems to be the crux, because mother's attorney said, every statutory factor seems to turn on that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. There was clear and convincing evidence in the record that overall, she basically has poor boundaries with this father. She historically has. She continued to have those poor boundaries throughout the trial. And her trial testimony was very concerning about her ability to recognize that father is actually a risk and her ability to take the steps she needs to protect the kids from this father. Throughout the case, and this was not just one child protection case, it was two, as is noted in the record, that spanned a period of 2 years. And the vast majority of that case, up until the month before trial, she denied that father caused these injuries, she minimized, she maintained an ongoing relationship with the father. As Ms. Galupa testified, the mother was telling the department throughout the case, I have no contact with him, I'm done with him, but that turned out to be not true. He appeared during at least one visit where they were together on video with the children. He FaceTimed the mother during a visit with the children during the case. He told the department that he got COVID from the mother from spending time with her during the case. She called the kids from and said she was at daddy's house during the case. They were having contact as recently as the morning of trial when he was offering her a ride to court. And even during her testimony, she minimized and denied the domestic violence that she experienced with the father. On the first day of trial, she testified that he had choked her up against a wall during the first child protection case. Then on the second day that she testified, she said, oh, he never choked me. He never really put his hands on me like that. There was some pushing and shoving. It just goes on to show that she still doesn't view him as a risk, and she is still willing to go to great lengths to protect this father. And the only point that she turned and finally had to say, okay, maybe he was responsible, was when she literally had no other choice because he had admitted in his criminal case that he had done it. That was the only time she was willing to at least feign any insight and agree that he had caused these injuries to the children. And the other concerning facts that existed at the time of trial, she had technically moved out of the apartment, but she was basically living across the street from the father. She had been trying for months and saying over and over again she was going to move farther and farther away, but she didn't have the money. But then she never asked the department for financial assistance, and at trial she testified money actually wasn't a problem. And as she sat there testifying at trial, she was still living across the street from this father. In addition, she said, oh, I want to get an order for protection. But she admitted multiple times during her testimony that she hadn't followed through, she hadn't filled out the paperwork, she hadn't taken the steps necessary to protect the children, despite the father stating under oath and finally admitting, I was the one that harmed these children. So for all of those reasons, her just concerning lack of insight throughout the case and her testimony at the time of trial and her failure to take steps to protect the children. In addition, there's definite credibility concerns, which the district court pointed out in its order to her testimony. The district court found that she overstated her ability to protect the children. And that is supported, again, multiple times by her contradictory testimony when it comes to the father and in her efforts to protect the father. I already pointed out the salient example of her telling the department she was having no contact with him during the case, which turned out to be not true. And then again, the lying about the domestic violence. Her testimony was that the domestic violence started and concluded during the first child protection case in 2020. Yet when the second child protection case came in, she told Dr. Harper that there was no domestic violence with father. She told the hospital social worker there was no domestic violence with the father. And then she also told the mental health and parenting assessor that there was no domestic violence with the father. This all undermines her credibility and her notion, her testimony, that she would be able to separate from the father and keep the kids safe from him. There was also concerning testimony when she was asked, as you sit here today, do you believe the oldest child when he said that dad hit the younger child? And her testimony was, well, it's hard to say. I know he said that, but... And that was after the father had already admitted to causing egregious harm to the child. She still was on the fence about whether or not she believed it as she sat there at trial and gave her testimony. She also made concerning statements about how, oh, he's dangerous right now, but maybe in the future things could change. She also had unrealistic expectations that the entire father's entire family would be around the children, but she would somehow be able to cut father out of that. She also said she would never tell the children anything bad about their father. She would let them reach their own conclusions. And then we also have to look to the historical length and depth of their relationship. This isn't somebody, you know, that she met on a dating app and dated for 6 months and then broke up with. This was somebody she had been in a relationship with for 12 or 13 years by the time of trial and was deeply intertwined, connected, and dependent on him, and had shown that time and time again she will protect the father and prioritize the father's interests over those of her own children. So moving on now to the evidence in the record that supported the argument that she either knew or should have known that father was the person that caused these injuries. I think the most salient piece of evidence is that this wasn't just one isolated incident. These children had multiple injuries that spanned almost 2 years. There were multiple broken ribs in two children, recurrent ear bruising in one of the children, recurrent facial bruising in another one of the children. And then we have the oldest child, once he was placed in foster care, making ongoing disclosures to his foster parent about witnessing domestic violence between his parents, also witnessing the father hitting the younger brother. He told Dr. Harper that he hit the child multiple times in multiple places, miming and mimicking on his own body to the front, to the back, and to the groin. And then we also have the oldest child having fear surrounding toileting because he told the foster parent that whenever he would make a mistake toileting, that he would get hit. So this is obviously an extensive pattern of abusive behavior on behalf of the father. And it's important to note, too, that there were two distinct and separate child protection cases. Then in the first child protection case, even if we give the mother the benefit of the doubt that she didn't know or shouldn't have known from that first child protection case, in that first case, she was put on high alert. She even testified, I had extensive conversations with Dr. Harper and other medical professionals about symptoms of child abuse, the facial bruising, that the broken ribs are an actual sign of the child being abused and violently squeezed. She learned about the broken femur from jerking or tugging. She was on high alert. She knew somebody had abused her child, and she knew what the signs of abuse were. Yet, when the second case came in, less than 8 months after the first case closed, she had not absorbed any of that information, and she was still focused on trying to protect the father. When Dr. Harper in the second case told her that the little girl's ribs had been broken, the mother knew at that point that rib fractures were from abuse. Dr. Harper reiterated that to her, and the mother was still insistent that the child had tantrums and threw herself on the ground. She still refused to believe it. On top of that, in the second child protection case, it opened with the older child spontaneously disclosing to his grandmother that he had seen the father strike the younger child. Respondent mother knew about that information, and that conversation happened 2 weeks prior to the child protection report being made. Instead of relying on her past knowledge and experience and saying, I know that my child was previously abused, I know that when my child was abused, he had marks on his face, I know that the man I'm with, who is a primary caregiver for my children, becomes violent when he's angry, and I know I have my oldest child telling trusted caregivers and relatives that the father did this. She had all of this information, and she didn't call child protection. She didn't proactively take him to the doctor. Instead, 2 weeks passed, and the relatives eventually had to call child protection and make a report, and that investigator was the one who set up the appointment with Dr. Harper to have the younger twin examined. That is a clear indication that this mother knew or should have known, based on that first child protection case and the direct statements of her own child of witnessing the abuse, that the father had abused this child, and she did not take steps to protect that child, and she did not respond appropriately to ensure that that child was protected from future abuse. In addition, there's the fact that the child, the oldest child, not only just disclosed to his grandmother, but he would basically disclose to anyone who would listen that this father was abusive to his younger siblings. He told the foster parent within moments of being in her home. He told a random stranger in the foster parent's building, hey, I live here because my daddy hits my brother. He told Dr. Harper. He told the corner house interviewer. And respondent mother and the department agrees that they have a very close relationship, and this child is very verbal. As the district court noted in its order, it is nearly impossible to believe that this child wouldn't have told his mother that this father was being abusive when we have him spontaneously disclosing to a stranger in the hallway of an apartment building. As I noted previously, this abuse was not an isolated incident. It was chronic and repeated over a period of nearly 2 years while they lived together in the same small apartment and were the two primary caregivers for the children. There's also the fact that the mother saw the father getting angry with the children, frustrated, and yelling at them. And from her own experiences with this father and his domestic abuse, she knew that he would become physically abusive when angry. She knew that she first saw the facial bruising after the father gave him, the younger child, a bottle, and he couldn't explain it. Dr. Harper even testified that should have been a red flag. She should have known that father caused that bruise. There's also the foster parent's testimony that she had text message conversations with the mother, where the mother admitted that she should have known that the father was doing this, based on the children's repeated injuries, his inability to explain them, and the history of domestic violence between them. There's also the evidence from the 2021 police report, where when the police responded to her home for the abuse of the children, the mother proactively approached the responding officer and said, "If father moves out, can I have the kids back?" The officer even noted in his own report that he found that highly suspicious, and it indicates that the mother either knew or at least strongly suspected that father was the one responsible. As pointed out in my brief as well, there's also evidence based on the mother's changing stories throughout the case, including in the 2021 police investigation when she initially blamed the child's injuries on throwing a toy or on the twin sister hurting the twin brother. However, then father gave a statement blaming the oldest child, and then a few days later, the mother had changed her story to mirror the father's explanation and excuse for the injuries. I mean, that's a reasonable conclusion that they were discussing what was happening and that they were coming up with a story together to place the blame on the oldest child. And moving on now to the burden-shifting argument, since that was also addressed, and I see I'm running out of time. As Your Honor noted, there were multiple repeated conclusions that the department has proven XYZ by clear and convincing evidence.
Well, I think that the conclusions of law says there is clear and convincing evidence that, as opposed to the department established by clear, it says there is clear and convincing evidence in one and two and three and four. So we don't know who proved it, but it would seem odd if the respondent were to prove something that
is unfavorable to,
right,
to
by clear and convincing
right.
evidence. And even if the respondent did do that, then there's, I think the concern is not just the burden, but the standard of proof here. The standard of proof has been, the court says, has been met. There's no argument it hasn't. It's the burden, and what do you do with that statement in page 18, paragraph 22.69?
Yeah, and I do agree that that statement in particular, I understand the concern there, but I agree with Your Honor that it has to be read in context. And in context, this is a 37-page TPR order where there, were repeated findings about the standard of proof being met.
Well, what's the harm of asking the district court to what's the harm in remanding for further findings in light of the proper burden of proof here?
Well, I think that would be unnecessary because they did apply the proper burden of proof, holding the department to its clear and convincing evidence standard. And as I argued in my brief, and there's case law to support it, sorry, I see I'm out of time, I'll just finish up this sentence. Even that sentence can be interpreted as the court weighing the contrary evidence. So the department put forth significant evidence that she either knew or should have known. So if mother wanted to present her own evidence to combat that, which she obviously is entitled to and she did in this case, the court is supposed to weigh that evidence. And in this case, it was saying, look, this mother has tried to present evidence that she didn't know, but it is not sufficient to outweigh the overwhelming evidence that she did know or should have known. So really, that sentence is not applying an incorrect burden of proof. It is just demonstrating the district court considering the mother's evidence and weighing it against the department's evidence and finding that it was insufficient. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to address a few issues raised by respondent. First, I just want to make clear that no one knew that father had committed all of the abuse until his admission the month before trial. The amount of times that it's inferred and assumed that mother knew
is
remarkable.
Did she know, or were there flags? Red flags that she should have seen.
So they're saying that she either knew or should have known. She did not know, and she did not have reason to know. The department didn't present enough evidence.
But you started by saying no one knew. And so I want to, is that really what we're asking? Or are we asking, should a reasonable person have known? And do you think the evidence supports a conclusion that someone or some people had reason to know?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I should have said no one knew or had reason to know okay. that father had committed all the abuse until his admission the month before trial. It is very notable that the department and the court lay all of the responsibility on who was the abuser at Miss LaPointe. When father got a diagnostic assessment, father also had a case plan. Father also had contact with the department. The department didn't have reasonable suspicion. The professionals didn't have reasonable suspicion. Your Honor mentioned that they're not there all the time. Miss LaPointe was also not there all the time. They were both parents to the children. They both had jobs. It is remarkable that all of the blame is laid at Miss LaPointe, and it's unfair. Another point I want to raise is it was raised that she does have poor boundaries with the father because she only moved across the street. That was due to financial situations. She tried to move somewhere else. She was looking at an apartment, and that apartment was infested with cockroaches, which wouldn't have been a great place for children. So she moved across the street. She didn't have the funds to get a different place. She shouldn't be punished for that. And that doesn't show that she has poor boundaries. The apartment had a lock and key. There was one visit where the father did appear. One visit is not sufficient evidence to show that that she can't keep him out of her life. She didn't have a order for protection against him yet, but she also didn't have the children back yet. There are a lot of assumptions and a lot of inferences made from these.
The nature of should have known is that we have to make inferences about what a reasonable person would or would not have known.
There has to be sufficient evidence, and there just isn't here. Also, to use the words that were just said, just because someone has been deeply intertwined with a partner doesn't mean there isn't dishonesty in a relationship. Miss LaPointe has always done and tried to do anything she can to get her children back. Miss LaPointe is an ideal parent and client. She took reasonable steps to locate the source of her children's injuries by frequently taking them to the doctor, obtaining second opinions, getting genetic screening, and working with the department. She also took reasonable steps to protect her children when she noticed grandmother had relapsed. Miss LaPointe has never missed a visit, and the bond between her children is clear and undisputed. Based upon the foregoing reasons, Ms. LaPointe respectfully requests this court reverse the district court findings and reverse and return the children to their mother. And in the alternative, we'd ask this court to reverse and remand back to the district court with the instructions to convert this case to a CHIPS case to allow Ms. LaPointe the time to prove that she is able and fit to take care of and protect her children. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. The matter is now under advisement. We'll issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. And the court will stand in recess so we can reconstitute our panel this morning for our final case.